must break the cycle of violence.
That the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
It is essential.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear this program at 96.5 FM if you're in the Sacramento area. And if you're just joining us, we're listening to Automation, Inequality, and What to Do About It, Insights into the World Where Machines Think and People Don't, with Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee, and they talk to Andrew Leonard.
I'm just riffled through a bunch of questions that kind of look past this towards the second part of your book. And before we break into the specifics, I think maybe we need to grapple with that more generally, which is that this pie is growing, but it doesn't appear to be distributed equally. And you know, if we can get to the root causes of that, then a lot of people want to know what to do about it.
Sure.
Well, why don't I touch on that one as well? I think a good example of what's going on is something that, in a conversation I ever heard about the same time that Andy was spitting his coffee out after reading about the Google self-driving car. I was getting on a plane, and the person in front of me was talking on his cell phone a little bit too loudly, so I couldn't help overhear what he was saying. And he was saying, oh, no, I don't use H&R Block anymore. I use TurboTax. It's faster, easier, cheaper, and it does things more accurately. And he was right, actually. TurboTax, does your taxes very accurately. And the way it does that is it took a process that used to be done by humans, and it codified it, and then it digitized it. And once it digitized it, you could make a copy of that. You can make 10 copies. You can make 100 million copies of it. And that's what they did. And each of those copies is identical to the original. It's a perfect copy. And it can be reproduced at virtually zero cost. And it can be transmitted anywhere in the world through the internet almost instantaneously. So this is a good that's free, perfect, and instant. Now, those are three characteristics we haven't had for most goods and services in the past. And they lead to some very unusual economics. In particular, they lead to winner-take-all markets or winner-take-all most markets. While each neighborhood or town might have a tax preparer a human tax preparer that could service them, with a tax preparation program, you don't want to have the thousandth best or even the second best program. You just want to buy the best one that's available. So those markets tend to concentrate to just one or maybe a handful of programs or of winners in those markets. And as a consequence, the revenues for that industry end up being much, much more concentrated. And what's more, it doesn't require a whole lot of people to make copies of TurboTax once the basic algorithms have been written. So you end up with some different economics. You get some winners and you get some losers. There's two groups of winners. One is a small group of winners, the people who create that, developers of TurboTax, the folks at Intuit. Some of them are billionaires. Many of them are millionaires. There's another very large group, which we shouldn't forget, which is consumers. People now have access to amazingly cheap, accurate software in this category that they didn't have before, and they can solve that problem more efficiently than they could before. But there's also some people who are made absolutely worse off. There are people who invest a lot of time and effort in learning how to do that profession, do that skill. Some of them went to college to do that. And now, in an economy where you're competing against a $39 piece of software, a human tax preparer doesn't add as much value. And it's not a coincidence that there are 17% fewer tax preparers than there were a couple of years ago, and the wages are under pressure. What I just described for TurboTax is a microcosm of what's happening in lots and lots of other industries. We're seeing it in obviously software and music and media, in manufacturing, in retailing, in finance. And as software eats more and more of the world, to use that phrase from Marc Andreessen, and as digitization becomes the core of more and more industries, we're going to see those same kind of economics affect more of more of society.
And Andrew, I love that example of Eric's because it illustrates the two main economic consequences that we spend the middle third of our book on trying to elaborate. That example hits them both. The first one is the good news. It's bounty. It's more, better stuff. And as Eric says, there are two different flavors of the bounty here. One is the rewards to the innovators, the people that came up with TurboTax. The other one, and to, again, repeat Eric, the bigger category is all of us who have access to higher quality, cheaper tax preparation. We think it's critically important not to lose sight of the fact that that is really good news. The bad news is the spread. Whenever I talk about the book, I've invented an incredibly dorky dance move because I keep on going like this. So instead of having an economy where our incomes and our wealth are pretty tightly clustered, thanks to phenomena like this, we're going like this, where the middle is being hollowed out. We've got a small group of people who know how to harness digital power and innovate with it. Their wealth goes way, way up. Their income goes way, way up. Middle is getting hollowed out, and the bottom is holding steady or gradually slipping behind. That's the spread. That's the challenge that we face in the second machine age. And our goal should be to keep the bounty going while minimizing the negative effects of the spread.
Well, what about the standard kind of economic theory that we hear that this automation may be occurring in some sectors, but that's going to release and increase productivity overall, and other sectors will pick up the slack and we'll get job growth to make up for that. Why is that, which seems to have held true,
since at least the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Why is that broken now?
For 200 years, people like us have been saying that the age of technological unemployment is nigh. It really started just about 200 years ago with the Luddites smashing looms in Britain. Definitely happened during the Industrial Revolution. John Maynard Keynes, who's kind of an intellectual hero of both of us, said in 1930, get ready, the era of tech unemployment is at hand. So the question's exactly right. Knowing that history and the historical pattern should calm us down a lot. Is this time finally different? Is the era finally here? The only honest answer is we don't know. It's too early to tell. But the data are not encouraging, and I think there are really good reasons to think that this time really is different. For all of human history, if you wanted a report written, you had to involve a person in that work. Not anymore. We've got software that can write good, clean prose. If you wanted to listen to a person, understand what they wanted, find an answer for them, and spit that back to them in human speech, you had to involve a human being in that work. Not anymore. I think we can go on and on. Diagnose a disease, drive a vehicle, answer a telephone, any of these things, we've always needed people for them. We don't anymore. So the digital encroachment into human territory is broad, deep, fast, and I think irreversible. To me, that feels like this time is different.
Hi, I'm Steve Lerman. I'm the guy that produces, edits, narrates, and promotes great speeches and interviews. I'm the guy responsible for airing in-depth interviews, speeches, and even debates on controversial subjects such as war and peace and climate change and the economy. I hope you like listening to it as much as I like producing it. Access Sacramento broadcasts it on the internet every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. And you can find the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com as well as at Facebook.
If you can't forgive me, then forgive me then. Why should I forgive you now? All of this goes way back when. Liking me was not allowed.
He says good.
And now, back to Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee and Andrew Leonard.
And it's not just the technology is different. The economic statistics suggest that something different is going on. I mean, we have to, as you exactly pointed out, Andrew, technology has always been destroying jobs, and it's always been creating jobs. And there's been this creative destruction, this flow, this turnover that's gone from one industry to another industry.
Yeah.
And for most of the past couple hundred years, those have been, since the first machine age, the Industrial Revolution, those have been roughly in balance. Yeah. And if you look at the trends, say, in productivity, employment, median income, they all kind of rose roughly in sync. But starting about 15, 20 years ago, they started diverging. Productivity has continued to grow, profits, overall GDP has continued to grow, but median income has stagnated, so it's not keeping up the way it did before. And employment has really stagnated as well. So there's something new going on, both in terms of the technology and in terms of the economic statistics. And we think the nature of the second machine age is at the core of that difference.
We don't think those two things are unrelated at all.
Well, then, what's going to happen to the working class? We have a direct question here. What are your views on organized labor? Technological advances seem to weaken the power of the working class. Is the working class doomed economically?
Well, we don't think they're doomed, but we do agree that the bargaining power has been weakened, and that reflects these underlying fundamental economics, that if a CEO or a company can make do with robots or software or machinery, then it's a lot harder for a working man or woman to bargain and say, hey, you know, give us our share of the revenues of the company, give us higher wages, or else we're gonna go on strike. Because if Terry Gao at Foxconn can say, hey, great, you guys go on strike, and we're going to replace you with robots. He's the guy who makes produces our iPhones over there. He says that he's going to hire 1 million robots. And that's a pretty severe threat, and it turns out an increasingly realistic one.
So the bargaining power of a worker goes down. Is there a credible alternatives? Right now in America, there are two really credible alternatives. There are workers in other countries, thanks to globalization, mm-hmm. and there is a digital alternative, which is already pretty good and only getting better. Eric's story about the robots for Foxconn shows that these alternatives are appearing even in the lowest wage parts of the world. But to try to get back to the question, it's way too early and way too defeatist to say that the working class in America is doomed. We just don't want to walk away and say, well, nothing to be done here, move on. The last third of our book is about the kinds of interventions that we think make sense in this era of pretty astonishing technological progress.
Well, you can jump in that, or I can give you a couple of, I mean, what knowledge, skills, and or dispositions do young people need to succeed in the new machine economy? What can we do to increase the educational and skill level to lead to more jobs when actually this is a much more specific question. So why don't we just start with the first
Let me say a little bit about that. So what the data say is that routine information processing tasks have been especially hard hit over the past 10 years. It's a little jargony, but it basically means following instructions, like that tax preparer that we were talking about, or travel agents. You know, you carry out information processing tasks, and it turns out that a big chunk of the American economy is devoted to exactly those tasks. But careful research by my colleague David Otter and others at MIT has found that if you look at the skill content of all the occupations in the United States, the more routine information processing is involved in that task, the more the demand has declined for them, the fewer jobs there are in those categories, the more the wages are under pressure. So if you are looking for a job to stay away from, it'd be lots of routine information mm-hmm. processing.
So in other words, a job that requires the three R's that we all still get taught so much of in primary education.
If you look at the way a lot of schools are structured, they're actually very much set up to get people to sit quietly in rows and learn how to follow instructions carefully. And that was, I think, a valuable skill in Henry Ford's 20th century era, where people had to work in assembly lines and follow instructions and each do something very consistently. But going forward, you know, those are exactly the kinds of skills, if you will, the tasks that robots are good at, mm-hmm. that machines are good at. What the machines are not particularly good at is creativity, inventing new things, entrepreneurial insights, or interpersonal relations, relating to other people. And we probably need to spend more time, or we do need to spend more time, reinventing education to focus on that set of skills, creativity, interpersonal relations, relating to other people, motivating people, caring for other people, that rather than the skills that were dominant in the second machine age of following instructions.
I have one question pushing back a little bit on the emphasis on education.
Mm-hmm.
How does increasing the educational and skill level of workers lead to more jobs when job creation is driven by aggregate demand within the domestic economy?
So there are two good questions down there. The first is about, is even if we can get the educational system right, would that be futile? Absolutely not. When Eric and I talk to business leaders, the most common complaint that we hear is, I cannot find people with the skills I need, all up and down the ladder, from my frontline employees up to the people at the very top of the company. I can't find folk with the skills that I need. Indicates to us that our educational system is turning out people that are mismatched to the job market out there. So right now, if we could wave our magic wand and fix education, we'd do a huge amount to help the unemployment and the wage crisis. The second part of your question, though, is about this concept of aggregate demand, which economists love to talk about. The way to think about it is captured in a wonderful, it's an apocryphal story, but a really good story about Henry Ford II and Walter Reuther, who was the head of the auto workers union, touring a really modernized factory. So they're looking through it, and Ford is in a playful mood, and he jabs Walter Reuther with his elbow and says, hey, Walter, how are you going to get those robots to pay union dues? And Reuther, without missing a beat, says, hey, Henry, how are you going to get them to buy cars? And in other words, this large, stable, prosperous American middle class that we created in the post-war decades, this was a phenomenal engine of demand. They bought a lot of stuff. They kept the economy growing. If we continue to polarize, if the middle gets hired out, it gets hollowed out more, does that demand dip? That's the definition of a recession. A recession, unfortunately, like we all know, is a nasty downward spiral of downward demand. We don't want that to happen.
But the core of that question has a worldview that I want to push back a little bit, which is that it's either or, that if we're having a recession, then there can't be any structural matters.
Yeah.
In fact, it's both. You know, so Paul Krugman and Larry Summers aren't in the room here, as far as I can tell. So I don't think they're...
if they were, we'd be hearing about it by now.
but there aren't any bigger advocates for trying to boost aggregate demand and stimulate the economy than we are. But that's a business cycle issue right now. And what we're talking about is some more fundamental, long-term structural issues. And for that matter, they're not unrelated. As Andrew was just saying, these structural issues can lead to the fundamental drop mm-hmm. in demand that we're seeing. And so you need to address both of them.
So you can run an economy with a very small group of the elite up at the top and a whole mass of fairly miserable people down at the bottom. It's feasible. It's just a lousy society. It's a smaller economy. It's not where we want to go at all.
And it'll almost certainly have political implications.
Absolutely.
Yeah, those tend to be unquiet places as well.
Just to circle back a little bit to your discussion of Henry Ford and the robots, you did anticipate two questions here. One is whether, given what we're seeing from long-term robot android development, should these workers be required to pay a partial amount of Social Security taxes?
Wait, which workers?
The robot.
You mean the android
robot
workers?
Robot.
Okay.
And relatedly, Henry Ford knew he needed the lower classes to consume his products and increased wages. Do you think modern tech barons and those who control our systems see things similarly?
And now, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Every first Monday in October, I put on my robe and hustle on over to serve as Supreme Court Justice. I never stop. Every year we hear 8,000 petitions. Every year we make 8,000 decisions. You think that once or twice I'll come out on top? Ha! No, it's 4-5. That's the vote on all opinions. How can we survive Judge Scalia and his minions? If we won just once, then we all should get a bonus. But till then, we'll have to grow some new cojones. Now you know my job isn't very easy. The other justices really displease me. I'm the only gal and I've had enough. Never mind that conservative faction. It's time I took affirmative action. Cause in our John, the seat is always up. It's an SOS to Miss Sandra Day O'Connor. Girlfriend, please come back. Help me to defend my honor, Clarence Thomas, please. He's convinced I can't resist him. How I'd love to knee him in.
I'll fix those right-wing men. I'll spike their Ovaltine with estrogen. But for now, I'm SOL, 'cause 4 to 5.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.